Hello and welcome to the Rogers Brief for December 17th, 2023. I'm Adam Rogers. Thanks for tuning in to watch and thanks for listening to those that are catching this on Apple or Spotify podcast. This is going to be the last Rogers Brief for 2023. I'll take a little Christmas break, come back in January with lots of news stories and all that, although I will be, I think, continuing on with the Sunday Night Show. We'll be doing that tonight with Jordan Bonaparte and the other guest, Paul Palango. So that's at 9:15 p.m. live on YouTube, and you can catch that as well if you look up the Nighttime Podcast or the Sunday Night Show podcast or YouTube, however you prefer to absorb that kind of content. So today, so for this week, I'm going to cover a few cases. One, just an interesting little legal concept out of a case where I argued an appeal this week. And then I'm going to talk about a few other Nova Scotia cases. One is this guy, Atwell, down in New Minas, the Annapolis Valley, and it's a right to counsel case, which some people may be surprised by the way it went in the end. The other one is a decision from Justice John Keith on where somebody's ashes should be buried. And this was a case out of the Sydney area and a divided family there. And so this was the first such case in Canada where a judge had to decide where ashes should be distributed, buried, how they should be dealt with. I'm going to talk about those. Another situation this week, the Mass Casualty Commission Committee, the follow-up committee on the implementation of the recommendations from the Mass Casualty Commission, met last week, and there's an update from that. A little bit of an update, not much of one, frankly, and that's a bit of an update in itself. I'll touch briefly on this story related to the Mass Casualty Commission about the Cape Breton Regional Police selling their decommissioned police vehicles. CBC article, good investigation by CBC on this to have found some problems with the sale of those vehicles. And then finally, I'm going to go down south just for a second because I've been watching a little bit of this. The Jack Smith special prosecutor into the election denial, election result fighting efforts of former President Trump. That is taking an unusual turn this week, and it's getting some attention, so I wanted to talk about that as well. The question of whether a former president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution. So that question, it's an outstanding question. Outstanding in both senses. hasn't been answered, and outstanding is that it is quite a question under the circumstances. That's going to be going straight to the United States Supreme Court. So I'll come back to that at the end, but I'm going to start with, so this week I did an appeal. In Nova Scotia, there's a special branch of the Public Prosecution Service that deals with sexual offenses, and set up because there's some unusual provisions about sexual assault cases that are different than others, and so they wanted to set up a specialized unit. Well, this specialized unit appealed a sentencing decision for a gentleman, a Cape Breton gentleman in this area, and as part of that, they said that Judge Alan Tufts misinterpreted a legal provision called, well, we've been calling it the Koch rule. It's spelled C-O-K-E, like Coca-Cola, short for Coca-Cola. It's actually pronounced Cook. It's an old British rule. It's actually from the Institutes of the Laws of England, written by Sir Edward Cook in 1628. So going back close to 400 years, this legal concept. And what is it? Well, it basically says that you cannot be more severely punished for a subsequent offense unless unless the punishment for the first offense took place before the second offense took place. All right, so let's break that down. So if you typically, if You do one break and enter, you'll be sentenced to something. And then if you do a second break and enter, you're going to get a greater sentence because obviously the first one didn't effectively dissuade you from that sort of activity. So the general rule in sentencing is you get a greater punishment for a second offense or subsequent offense. And sometimes that's just a common law principle of sentencing, and sometimes, like in drinking and driving, that is legislated. So in drinking and driving, your second offense, you're going to get 60 days in jail, greater fines, third offense, 90 days, and so it's legislated. But even if it's not, usually for a second offense, you get a greater sentence. Well, the Cook rule, says that unless you've been convicted of the first offense when you commit the second offense, then you cannot be subject to that greater punishment general rule. So in this case, it was cases of abuse. So, you know, not certainly unpleasant topics to be covering, but they're criminal offenses and they apply across the board. And this was a, you know, we weren't arguing about the guilt or innocence. It was just, well, how did this Coke rule apply? So the Crown got this wrong. The judge acknowledged that during the appeal, that the trial judge, Judge Tufts, did properly apply the Coke rule. So anyway, sometimes you think, well, the laws are evolving and all these things, but sometimes you go back to 1628 and you use a legal principle that was articulated a long time ago and has stood the test of time. So anyway, that was part of my week. Next thing I want to talk about is this case out of Sydney. And this was a case where a lady died. I think she was close to 90 years old. She might have been 90. And had named three executors. She had seven or eight children, three daughters, and named all three of her daughters as her executors. This is something I will say parenthetically that I usually advise against, and just for the reasons as came out in this case. You get arguments and disagreement, and then what do you do? In this case, there was a situation, so the mom was cremated, and her name was Anne Curry, and she had three daughters, Mary, Patty, and Paula. Paula and Patty thought that, okay, so she was an only child, Anne, but she had many children herself, and she had a husband, and difficulties in the relationship, but it was, a 68-year marriage. So a long-term relationship. And the question was, would her ashes be buried in St. Mary's Cemetery near Sydney, next to her husband? And her husband had put together, her name was already on the gravestone, and they had put together a grave marker there. Or would she be buried with her parents in the new Calvary Cemetery in Whitney Pier? And she was an only child, very close to her parents when they were alive, and so Mary, one of the daughters, thought that the ashes should be divided between the two sites, and then in addition, that if any of the children wished to have some of their mother's ashes, that they would be permitted to do so. Paula and Patty, on the other hand, said, well, no, she was living separate from their father since 2004 for a while, died a couple of years ago, so living apart from her husband for quite some time, and had written this letter, which she kept in a safe lockbox, saying basically, you know, I don't want to be there, I don't want to be buried among people that didn't like me, her husband's family primarily, and that was some difficulties. Well, there was further evidence, however, that the letter was written many years ago when her husband and her were split and, you know, in a bad place in their relationship. And there were some other letters too that sort of reflected the animosity. But she kept the letters, but she also kept stayed married, never actually got divorced from her husband. And in addition, had told a good friend, who was a friend and also a friend of Paula, one of the daughters, that was sort of on the other side of this argument, before she died, that actually she would like to be buried partly there and partly at the Whitney Pier Cemetery. So there's some dispute in the evidence about what her intentions were. The other thing is, in the will, she said, all right, she named the three executors, but then she said there was a majority clause. Basically, if they disagree, if the two of the three agree, then that's the way it will go. All right, so with all that, we had two of the three saying, bury her in Whitney Pier with her parents, away from her husband, their father. All right, so this is Justice John Keith, who's been a justice now for a few years. I knew Justice Keith back when he was a lawyer and I was articling. He was an associate at Cox and Palmer, a litigator, very well respected at the time. Well articulated decision in this case. He says, well, yes, the general rule is that the majority rules in those cases where the executors disagree, but it's not quite so simple. The majority must be reasonable and respectful of the minority opinion. You know, there's no, it's not like an official decision-making authority where you need to show that you've done this and demonstrate fairness and all that stuff. But there is a requirement for a reasonable and respectful view of the minority opinion. He found that that didn't take place here. And the other one, the overriding rule of it all, is that basically no matter what somebody says in their will, and he went through some historical examples of this, the court ultimately has authority to determine whether there's a dignified, dignified outcome to it all. So you can't just ask to be buried in some elaborate or, you know, public or some unusual way. The court retains authority. And by the way, they say you cannot have property in a dead body either. So the executors don't possess the body in the same way you would, you know, possess any other personal possession, clothing, vehicle, or anything else. You don't have ownership in a body. It's just you have possession of it. You have control of it for the purposes of ensuring that it's buried in the proper way. I wanted to read a paragraph from the decision. This is paragraph 9 from Justice Keith's decision, talking about the family. It says, overshadowing the legal questions in this case are the complexities of family dynamics, knotted and gnarled by conflicting feelings of loyalty and love, devotion and distrust, sibling respect and sibling resentment. The resulting dissonance is obviously not unique to the Curry family, but it does scrape through the evidence. Each side claims a deep understanding of their mother's final wishes, but their respective understandings are incompatible. Each side invokes their mother Anne Curry's life experiences, yet their perspectives are clearly colored by their own personal, not their mother's, experiences. Each side recalls the deep and loving bond between Anne Curry and all her children, but they have allowed her memory to divide them. Each side is determined to honor and respect their mother, but one is left wondering whether Anne Curry would feel honored and respected watching her children quarrel in open court over her remains. Well, that says something now. So anyway, I thought this decision is kind of interesting that it came out just before Christmas and lots of family gatherings and all of that stuff, and maybe people will take some guidance from those words, from Justice Keith, wise words. So in the end, what did he do? So Justice Keith decided that the more current interpretation of Anne Curry's wishes was to have her ashes divided, some in with her husband and some with her parents, and that's what he decided. What he did not do was allow any additional division of her ashes to the children. He said, well, first of all, the request was to give ashes to whichever children wanted them, which created some uncertainty. We didn't know which ones would want them. And there was no guarantee at that point that the ashes would be treated in a respectful manner. Or, well, the way you put it, there was no real guarantee as to what might happen, and so the court couldn't be assured that they would be disposed of in a respectful manner. So, anyway, that's how, those are the kinds of things that can get decided in court. All right, next case. This is Daryl Murray Atwell. And it's a case, Mr. Atwell, a man with double letters in all three of his names, Daryl Murray Atwell, right to counsel 10B charter case. So Mr. Atwell was arrested in May 13th of 2021, and he was arrested for being an accessory after the fact of the murder of Robert Campbell and then of criminal negligence causing death. Now, this decision on the rights to counsel doesn't actually get into the details of how the murder was alleged to have taken place or that, but focuses more so on his initial police interview. And this interview, I think it's interesting on its own right, but also for people that followed the coverage of the Mass Casualty Commission, you'll recognize a few of the police officers' names from the Mass Casualty inquiry and investigations. So this was in New Minas, as I think I mentioned at the beginning, and he was arrested, Atwell was, by Constable Brad Williams. Now, Constable Williams informed Mr. Atwell of his right to speak to a lawyer. So Atwell calls the lawyer of his choice, who was Bernard Conway, who is a lawyer out of Kentville, private practice lawyer. He doesn't advertise himself as a criminal lawyer, although the decision said he did represent Mr. Atwell previously in criminal court, but also mentions that he was a school classmate, not a law school, but a like elementary and high school classmate of Mr. Atwell. Atwell, I think, owns a farm, had employees, had a criminal record, which became relevant to the judge's decision. Justice Gatchalian was the judge on this. So he calls Bernard Conway. Conway can't represent him, tells him not to say anything. And Conway had something else going on in his life, some personal circumstances. He said, I can't represent you, but I'm telling you, don't say anything. So from there, Atwell gets a phone call with Nick Hone, who is a legal aid lawyer who was on duty counsel that night. There's always a lawyer on duty counsel if somebody needs advice over the phone upon being arrested. So then he talks to Nick Hone for about 15 minutes. Again, Nick Hone, the evidence establishes, told him not to say anything. They talk about bail. They talk about a number of things as you would speaking to somebody who's just been arrested. Basically tell them not to say anything. The police can hold you for 24 hours, and then you think about a bail plan if there's any kind of a hope to get bail. Be tough in these circumstances anyway, but anyway, that would be all those things you'd be talking about during that 15 minutes. So then he goes from there, and he is interviewed by Corporal Gerard Rose Berthume. And Corporal Rose Berthume was the officer who walked Lisa Banfield through the reenactment. So that was kind of interesting because during the six hours interview with Atwell, about 6 hours in, Atwell gives an incriminating statement and agrees to conduct a reenactment of the situation. All right, so everything seems fine. Well, here's the wrinkle. After Nick Hone got off the phone with Atwell, he calls senior legal aid lawyer Ken Greer because there's a policy that legal aid has, which is if somebody is accused of, you know, something involving a wrongful death or a death, then they'll arrange to have somebody, a lawyer, go speak to the person in person. And so Ken Greer was prepared to do that and called up Constable Williams and said, I can be there in person. Let me know if Atwell wants that to take place. So then the RCMP had a conversation. Should we tell Atwell, the accused, that he has this offer that senior legal aid lawyer Ken Greer is willing to come here in person and speak to you and give you advice. The police do not tell him, and they this is at the direction of Staff Sergeant Greg Vardy, and Greg Vardy's name would be familiar. He was the officer who interviewed Lisa Banfield during the early days of the investigation into the mass casualty and the days following the killings. So they tell, they meet the officers, and they do not tell Atwell that he has this offer. So that's the issue. Did they have the obligation to tell him? And Justice Gatchalian goes through all of this and says, no, they did not have an obligation to tell him. He did have legal advice. He had two sources of legal advice, both of which told him not to say anything. So he had the quality of the legal advice certainly couldn't be attacked as deficient. The police just wore him down, and they had 24 hours. They asked him questions, and they kept pressuring him, and he could have said nothing. And he did say nothing for a long time, but then they, eventually he decided that he would. So not a charter violation in that case to have denied him the option. That one certainly could have gone either way, when you have somebody that's willing to come down and speak to somebody in person. Do you at least let them know? If Ken Greer had shown up, certainly I think they would have had to tell Atwell that he was there. Hard to believe that they would be able to deny him access to Atwell if he had showed up. But if he's just saying, well, I could come down, do we let him know? The answer is they didn't have to. Now, what came out at the end of the decision as well is that Atwell was somebody with, he's 43 years old, he owns a farm, he's not, he's had some level of intelligence, and he had a criminal record too, so he had experience with those interviews. And throughout the interview as well, he repeated that he understood that he didn't have to say anything. He just did. And so you have to live with that if you're the accused. So according to this decision. All right, next story I get to. The Mass Casualty Commission, the committee, 16-member group led by former Court of Appeal Justice Linda Oland, who is in this position for 1 year. So she's not halfway through her term yet, but she's well into it at least. Now, we didn't get very much from the news reports or from Justice Oland other than to say everything's fine. Not much detail at all. This group is bound by confidentiality, each of the members of this implementation oversight committee. So none of the other individuals in the committee spoke a word. Justice Oland didn't provide any details, but said that the federal government, the provincial government, and the RCMP all provided updates, and that in her view, nobody is dragging their feet. She had no complaints to that effect, but did not articulate any details on what level of implementation of any of the 130 or so recommendations has been made. And she said, the object of the committee is not to, quote, check boxes and get to the finish line as quickly as we can. Okay, isn't it? I guess maybe not. I thought maybe it would be the hope of the committee that these organizations that are implementing the recommendations would, in fact, try to do that as quickly as possible and make things happen. Other details that came out, the committee has submitted a budget to the federal and provincial governments, but that budget has not yet been approved, even though we're well into the mandate of the committee, and that their next meeting is sometime in the spring, so months from now, and they'll watch again. So very little, the Mass Casualty Commission inquiry was supposed to be a very public process, and it was. This implementation has been extremely private, We don't know anything from other than the fact that the feds, the province, and the RCMP presented to this committee over the 2 days where they were meeting. We don't know anything else. So it doesn't inspire confidence. I'm sure we'll be talking about this tonight with Jordan and Paul. The other side of this, this isn't related to the committee, but related to the Mass Casualty Commission, is this story out of Cape Breton Regional, where the police down there, the Cape Breton Regional Police, have been selling decommissioned vehicles. So the CBC reporter, I think it was Tom Ayers, went to the auction and saw that on some of the vehicles there were still reflective markings, and in two of them there were documents in the center console of the vehicles. One was a wanted poster with an accused name, and the other one was just a request sheet for an oil change, but signed by one of the police officers. Unbelievable that that would still be taking place. But reflective markings, now the police spokesperson said that before they're actually sold, they'll go through a further process. But we'll see. And there was a note in the article as well that the police themselves, the officers, were hoping if there was some blanket ban that there would be an exception for former police officers to be able to purchase these vehicles. Not so sure about that either. So we'll see. We'll see what happens as a result of this. It just shows the problem, though, doesn't it? I mean, when you're trusting, when things are decommissioned, that you cannot identify them as a police vehicle. Well, if there's reflective markers and documents and stuff still on them, then that's hardly solving the problem and just illustrates the extent of the problem. All right. Last thing I want to talk about, just if anybody's interested, is go looking south of the border and to the Donald Trump criminal allegations that he tried to steal the election after losing the vote and the Electoral College to current President Joe Biden. Anyway, so Jack Smith, the Ironman triathlete, Jack Smith, competitive triathlete, is special counsel and is prosecuting former President Trump. And what he's done is something unusual. So one of the questions that the Trump defense team has raised is whether, as a former president, he is immune from criminal prosecution. And there is some basis for this argument. Now, presidents cannot be sued civilly for anything that they do while president. And so the question is a former president, quote, absolutely immune from federal prosecution for crimes committed while in office? Well, a trial court has already said no, not immune. The normal next step would be appealed to a circuit court. There's several levels of appeal in the United States before it would ever get to the U.S. Supreme Court. The problem is this, from Jack Smith's perspective, is that's going to run out the clock. And he suspects, or they seem to suspect, or they're concerned, that that is the Trump defense team plan. Get this past the next election, at which point Trump will be president again, and he can just wipe this whole thing out. Well, currently there's a trial date for this starting March 4th. And that date happens to be just before 16 states vote in the Republican primary. Super Saturday, it's called. All right, well, that's unfortunate timing, perhaps, in a sense, although none of the fallout of these trials has hurt Trump politically very much in the polls, it seems. But the concern is that you're going to trial just before everybody votes, and that could be a problem for him politically. Well, Smith says we need to skip through those cases, because if it goes to the next level of appeal, it's just going to be months before it gets argued, maybe a long time before a decision, and then months again before it would ever get to the Supreme Court of the United States. So let's just skip to the end and make our arguments there. Supreme Court has agreed to do so. This is certiorari before judgment. That is, before there's a lower court judgment, that they will take it on and make a decision. They've agreed to do that. So what's going to happen? There's some precedent for this now, too, of doing the quick route to the Supreme Court of the United States. This was done in President Nixon's time in Watergate, when he was President Nixon was withholding certain tapes and other document evidence about Watergate and their involvement. And so that went straight to the Supreme Court without going through all the appeal levels. Same as this. Here's what I suspect is going to happen. I think that the Supreme Court is going to say no. There's not an absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for former presidents. You know, if a former president, you know, you can order a military strike, you're not going to get charged with murder. But if you, in your private life, or if you, you know, you're at an event and you kill somebody, or if you killed somebody, you know, as an individual, you shot somebody, well, sure, certainly you can be charged with murder. So there cannot be an absolute immunity. But I think what they will say is, if what you're doing is connected to politics, if there's a real connection to a political objective, then that does create an immunity from the president, and the scope of what would be a political act, a political decision, a political situation when you're the president is going to be a very wide scope. And it's going to include this. I think the Supreme Court's going to shut this down, and not just because three of the nine have been appointed by Trump of the Supreme Court justices on the current bench, but I just think they're going to say, well, no, because we can't have everything. I think they'll see that the Justice Department is becoming politicized, and one way to stop it is to say no. If you're the president, if it's adjacent to a political act, then you can't be prosecuted, and stop this from cycling through. Because of course, if Trump gets in, he'll have the Justice Department prosecuting things that Joe Biden did, and on and on and on it'll go. And you know, that's just not good for the political life of a country. So anyway, we'll see what happens. So that'll be sometime in the next couple of months. We'll get to hear the arguments. The briefs are due, I think, by the 20th of December. So we're going to see soon what the arguments will be. Hopefully we get a hearing sometime in January or early February, and a decision well before that March 4th trial date, and see what happens from there. All right, well, that's it for this week. That's it for 2023. I hope everybody's enjoying that. I hope everybody has a great Christmas and take a little time to recharge and get back strong for 2024. So until then, I'll be taking a little break myself, other than the Sunday night show. I'll see everybody there if you're tuning into that. And otherwise, we'll see you next year back in the Rogers Brief. Thanks again for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.